Hello and welcome to New Books in Literary Studies on the New Books Network. I'm your co-host, Annette Joseph-Gabriel. Today, I have with me Stefan Robelin to talk about his book, Grounds of Engagement, Apartheid-Era African-American and South African Writing. Stefan is an associate professor of English at Rutgers University, where he's the director of the Center for African Studies. He also teaches courses in African literature, African diaspora studies, and post-colonial literature and theory. Stefan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Annette, for the invitation. It's a real pleasure to talk with you.
I'm really excited to have you on. So in your book, you examine the exchanges between South African and African-American writers in the 20th century. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to this project?
Yeah, well, so it has a very long trajectory, which is to say that it was born in my undergraduate studies. As an undergraduate in college, I quickly gravitated towards African-American literature, but later in my studies began to read and look at African literature. And so when I had a chance to write my honors thesis, I took the opportunity to plunge into South African literature, which actually tied back prior to my studies because I was growing up in the apartheid, the anti-apartheid era of the 1980s, had a sort of a political interest in South Africa. Yeah, so that's my undergraduate studies. When I went into graduate school, I had the idea that I'd place African and African-American literature in conversation with each other. And the dissertation that I eventually wrote was ultimately a sort of a standard comparative project. So, you know, I paired African-American and Black South African texts alongside each other. And I read them sort of parsing out how they echoed one another and the tensions that emerged between them. By the end of the dissertation, however, I grew slightly disenchanted with its form. It felt rather mechanical. And so while I found the work valuable, I was also a bit restless. So when it came to turning the dissertation into a book, I really undertook a radical revision. And that started with the methodological questions that drove and governed my research. So the dissertation posed the straight comparative question, which was, you know, what are the similarities that we can find across Black South African and African American texts, and you know, what do they tell us about the nature of resistance, among other things? But for the book, I wanted to dig underneath that question. And to really ask what kinds of exchanges took place that facilitated the transatlantic echoes that I was examining in the dissertation in the first place. So I began to zero in instead on what I've been calling cultural infrastructure, the exchanges, the actual relationships between writers. Their conversations are mostly in that period, their letters. Essentially, the cultural traffic of books, but also of writers themselves, who under, you know, frequently very challenging circumstances, moved transnationally. So really, it shifted from a classically comparative project to a much more relational project. So that's the first sort of major sort of alteration that I made in the project, but there was a second methodological shift that also took place, and that's one that that we can think about as a kind of an anti-diffusionist approach. By that I mean sort of working against the tendency in literary and cultural studies that takes a look at transnational relationships, but too frequently in a one-sided way. So what happened too often, American literary production is imagined as the kind of the central source of innovative work and creativity. and then whose influence then sort of diffuses out into the rest of the world. And the rest of the world then gratefully accepts it or revises it or refashions that kind of originary work. But this is, you know, essentially a one-way street. And there's a series of problems with that kind of approach. As valuable as exploring that direction is, there hasn't been sufficient attention to the way that Black South African literature and culture, for example, have formed and shaped African American literature and literary production. So the one thing that I insist on in this book is tracing the lines of influence in both directions. Mm-hmm. That's part of the kind of excavation that I'm interested in. So just to give you an example, Black Boy by Richard Wright, his autobiography made a huge impact on the Black world. Clearly within the United States, but also well outside of the United States. So, that book's and even his short stories' impact on South African writers was considerable. So Peter Abrahams, Eskia Mpahlele, Kera Phetseko Setsile, all of these are Black South African writers who talk about this sort of their transformative encounters with Wright's work. But what is less figured into the equation are the ways that interactions with South African writers and activists sort of change the way that African American literature took shape. You've got sort of interactions with activists and writers that led to Audre Lorde's work on South Africa, including her essay "Apartheid USA" and, mm-hmm. and some of her own poetry, poetry of Cheryl Clarke and Michelle Cliff, also very much bear the imprint of South Africa in their work. Even Gwendolyn Brooks, who actually mentored Willie Kosetsile, would begin to write about South Africa herself in poems like The Near Johannesburg Boy or Music for Martyrs and her long poem Winnie. And that comes out as a result of that friendship. So I'm really looking at a much more two-way street.
That's really fascinating to hear, I guess, just the movement, your own trajectory and how you move from the questions that you're asking, through undergrad, through the dissertation, through the manuscript, and the new directions that these questions start to take, and how that seems to be paralleled in certain kinds of ways by the movement that you're thinking about in the book itself, or how you're asking us to rethink movement, right? That's not the sort of one-way street, but rather the sort of multi-directional exchange that's happening. And I'm really fascinated by the way that you talk about movement, because I found the title Grounds of Engagement really compelling. And I also found the cover image, right? So I'm looking at the book right now and it's this picture of an open field and sky. And I find those two elements really interesting because they both speak to the spatial analysis that you undertake in your work. In particular, you assert that, and I'm quoting from your work here, quote, "Geography is central to the process of Black transnational relation," unquote. So I guess my question is, how does paying attention to space and the geographies imagined by these writers help us to better understand, right, the kind of apartheid politics, the contestation of power and the possibilities of belonging in apartheid South Africa and the United States in the period that you're looking at?
Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks for that. Movement really is quite key, quite essential to the way I'm thinking. I'm a very sort of visual person. Mm-hmm. I process things quite visually. And so I'm, you know, for this entire project, I was just sort of imagining, you know, sort of little dots moving across the map, back and forth, on a regular basis. And so, but space is what is key here. So let me just zero in on your question about the title itself, because, like the image, it carries a fair amount of meaning. The grounds of engagement as a title is a pun, or really it's a double entendre. So in the first instance, what I mean to evoke, in the title is a question of, how and why we understand South African and African American relationships, or relation itself. Mm-hmm. On what conceptual or methodological grounds, in other words, on what rationale do we rest our comparison between two Black communities or their two countries, right? So there's a reason for this, because so often comparisons, particular in popular culture, are grounded in notions of family or essentialist notions of race, notions that that don't always account for the considerable differences between the Black communities, mm-hmm. When in fact there are considerable differences, for example, in language and in racial classification. Mm-hmm. Different histories produce both of those, right? But of course, what I mean to invoke is that over and above these differences, there have been writers who have writers and thinkers and artists who have fashioned and made visible the similarities between those communities, again, over and above those differences. So this is all the more significant because I'm tracking a cultural relationship that doesn't adhere to the classical diaspora model, mm-hmm. If that makes sense. So whereas African Americans can claim some kind of cultural and genetic tie back to West Africa and Central Africa due to the horrors of the transatlantic slave trade, the relationship between Black America and Black South Africa is a different kind, if you will, in the sense that it's a more political and an ideological relationship. Mm-hmm. So that's the, you know, sort of the grounds, the rationale for thinking about the relationship between these two communities. But I said it was a double entendre. So the second evocation of grounds of engagement is, as you say, focused on geography, on questions of physical space and on spatial relationships. Mm. Not only do these two communities share histories of entrenched racism, but these are histories of segregation. Mm. Fueled by globally connected regimes of white supremacy.
Right.
And there, racism played out by way of spatial demarcation, separation of people according to racial categories, right? So these are materially entrenched histories of segregation, and they're interconnected as well. There were ways that South Africa... the South African regime, apartheid regime, studied the ways that segregation operated in the American South and implemented portions of those tactics. So they're interconnected, but that kind of material entrenchment of segregation has had a profound impact. It's still being felt today. We only need to see the ways the legacy of residential segregation plays out in a quote unquote integrated educational system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's profound to our and leads to our current moment. But it's also profound in the ways that spatial arrangement and and racial separation and estrangement impinge in fundamental ways on our imaginations, on how people begin to think about their place in the world, what spaces they can't or can access, mm-hmm. what racial rules govern behavior in a particular space, how they can move, through segregated worlds. And it begins to shape people's consciousness about who they are and how it pervades the way that people express themselves. And what I'm really charting is the ways that that Black literature expresses and Black writers express that spatial consciousness, if you will. Mm. So you know, one of the arguments in my book is that representations of racialized space in literature is a way, a medium through which Black writers began to relate to one another and to one another's experiences. So, you know, they could read in a given text. We'll go with Black Boy again. They could read in the sort of the description of the physical and of the social space in sort of Richard Wright's South, the racist division of space, and then begin to judge their proximity to it, mm-hmm. right? Not in terms of physical proximity, but in terms of the experiential proximity. Mm-hmm. How many times, you know, they as readers, in this case, as readers, encountered the same spatial problem because of how racist law and custom in South Africa and the U.S. organized Black life, right? Mm-hmm. Now, there's a physical geography. We see this, oftentimes in autobiographies, as people are sort of charting the ways that they came to consciousness growing up and realized questions of race, questions of inequality. But there's also a more metaphorical imagined geography that I'm interested in exploring. And that is not just charting, but sort of reconfiguring mm-hmm. The lay of the land, if you will, right? So many Black writers also work to imaginatively reorganize segregated space and really to rethink and reimagine different forms and different boundaries of community. And sometimes that would expand outwards to a transnational community. Mm-hmm. And I found this most clearly expressed in the poetry of Kositsile, of Michelle Cliff, of Gwendolyn Brooks. I should also point out that the issue of transnationalism itself at bottom is an inquiry into a geographical question, right? Mm-hmm. That is, how do physically discontinuous groups of people, right? People who are separated by space, in this case, separated by an Atlantic Ocean, connect or try to connect and relate to one another across that space, right? That's really one of the key questions driving this inquiry into transnationalism, and that's what the book is trying to get after.
Mm. I love this idea of connections, and I'm really intrigued by the image with which you began when you talked about being a visual thinker and therefore sort of visualizing and imagining dots moving across the map. It's such an evocative image, and you also talk about reconfiguring, right? I think you do that in multiple ways in this text, because in addition to thinking about that in spatial terms, I think that you're also reimagining generic boundaries and borders as well. And so that there are multiple crossings that are happening in your work, right? So in addition to the geographic crossings that you tease out in your transnational approach, you also work across different genres. You look at letters, poetry, novels. How do these generic crossings allow us to think differently about the works of these authors and their contributions? Because a lot of these authors are really quite well known, and so I think that there's certain kinds of ways that we think about their work or their oeuvre. But how does working across these different genres allow us to rethink what these authors are doing in their writings?
That's a really great question. So, you know, I mean, it really was important for me to show that sort of that transatlantic movement of writers, the ways that Wright left the United States, Peter Abrahams left South Africa, and both would meet in England and France, for example, right? Mm-hmm. But it was equally important for me to chart the movement of letters of people who didn't have the same mobility, which was why I wanted to examine, in particular, the letters between Bessie Head. Bessie Head, a South African exile who was based in Botswana, and African-American women writers, Alice Walker, Nikki Giovanni, Toni Morrison, and Michelle Cliff. And I mean African-American in a broadly in a broad way, to mm-hmm. also include Caribbean writing. Mm-hmm. That's for Michelle Cliff, who ended up, of course, spending a good deal of her life in the United States. Mm-hmm. But what came clear to me across all of these interactions was not only how writers shared their work and the work of others by mail. They would sort of pass along magazines and books and clippings that that they came across. But those different kinds of writings would make profound impacts, right? So Bessie Head, for instance, would send her novels. But it was also her extraordinary and elaborate letters, many of which read like essays of literary and cultural criticism, that were gratefully received. In other words, you know, Head would get a copy of you know, Nikki Giovanni's poetry and write her back a treatise on the poetry itself, and sort of weave in elements of Head's own life to show their connection, as well as you know, the sort of meeting points, emotional and literary meeting points. That's also the case that with Alice Walker, she would share multiple genres of her work, right? So she would send her poetry as well as her fiction. In her case, she even came to share a drawing of a garden of flowers that was named Bessie, Alice, and Howard. And Howard's the name of Bessie Head's son. Mm-hmm. So really all kinds of writing and forms of expression landed in each other's laps. So it occurred to me that all of these circulating texts would have an impact on the recipient, especially those unpublished letters, but that, you know, they were no less valuable, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that there really is a need to evaluate some published work according to the genre that it's written in, mm-hmm. The form that it takes, that creates the conditions for the meaning of the content. It's part of the content, if you will. There's room for that kind of evaluation, and we see that most explicitly in the poetry of Langston Hughes, which I start out with in the book. Also, the poetry of Brooks and Cossetile. All of them thread together different geographic spaces. They literally connect South African and African American cities across their poetry. Mm-hmm. But they also put great pressure on line breaks, for example. And someone like Kotsitsile sets up some remarkable chains of prepositional phrases, which are really questions of relation itself, right? That, after all, is what the prepositional phrase is doing.
Right.
And so the book explores this in some detail, but it's I feel like it's also really important to step back and appreciate the kind of multi-generic consumption mm-hmm. that the writers themselves were engaged in, mm-hmm. right, as they were sharing different types of work. And on top of that, I'm interested in making sure that we recognize that the published material that the readers encountered is not only literary or literarily, it's not the only literary or literarily influential matter that gets exchanged between writers, mm-hmm. that in some ways that sort of finished work is only a small, is a small portion of the spectrum that can be influential on the receiving author, right?
Yes.
So it might have us rethink what we talk about when we talk about primary texts, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. That there are other kinds of works that the receiving writer is encountering and moved by and connected through.
Right. Well, I'm so glad you brought up the image of Alice Walker's flower garden. It's such a fascinating drawing in the book. And you also talk about this sort of multi-generic consumption. But I think there's also this idea of sort of inscription and self-production that's happening in these different genres that are being circulated. And so you begin, or sort of early on in the book, you have this hand-drawn map of Cape Peninsula by Richard Reeve that traces a particular geography in his correspondence with Langston Hughes. And then later on, you have this letter from Alice Walker to Bessie Head, and you have this really interesting flower garden image. And kind of between these two hand-drawn, I want to say objects, artifacts, images, you kind of examine, right, these multiple acts of self-production by writers who are inscribing themselves into a space, or they're interpreting or reinterpreting that space through their hand-drawn maps. So how would you describe the alternative geographies, if you will, that are produced in these maps? And how are these alternative geographies imagined differently or on different terms across the Atlantic? Because very early on, you talked about, you know, your interest in this comparative work that you're doing in looking at the echoes and tensions. And so when these writers are imagining these alternative geographies in their correspondence with one another, how are they doing so in ways that find echoes in the other's work, but also in ways that are on very different terms?
That's great. That's great. So, I really appreciate your attention to the visual documents, those forms of representations. You're right. They're sort of incredible visual texts. And I think of them mostly as maps, not just sort of literally so. Or it may have us rethink what we mean, you know, or sort of dig deeper when we think about maps and what their function is.
Mm-hmm.
So these really are part of that influential material that gets passed around or gets passed over the Atlantic, right? So the Richard Reeves map of the Cape Peninsula that you're talking about, and Walker's drawing the three flowers on the ground soaking up the sun, were really aha moments for me. These are moments in which, you know, I found sort of very explicitly the ways in which writers are processing and expressing themselves in spatial terms.
Mm-hmm.
Reeve had sent his literally hand-drawn map to Langston Hughes by way of introduction. It was really a reminder of how we all kind of draw maps, metaphorically speaking, mm-hmm. when we get to know someone, especially someone we want to impress, which was the case with Reeve and Hughes. It's most obviously, as you say, a form of self-representation and self-fashioning, but I was immediately struck by how profoundly spatial that form of self-representation was. Mm-hmm. He introduced himself by drawing visual and textual maps of his environment, right? And in Reeve's case, it spoke to how deeply his consciousness was marked by the geography of a racialized Cape Town. Mm-hmm. Like that would be his form of introduction, right? For Walker, she expresses herself. So I'm going to use your terminology. So the way in which he interpreted his world mm-hmm. and sort of channeled that over to Hughes. For Walker, it was much more of a kind of a reinterpretation. She's expressing herself also in a spatialized way, but her drawing of the three flowers sharing the same flower bed is really a kind of an imaginary map that's meant to express their prevailing over the physical space that divides them. Mm-hmm. Head being in a village, Sorowe, in Botswana, and Walker being in New York without at that point having ever met. So it's an expression of emotional proximity and a literal and also metaphorical shared ground that nurtures them, right? Mm-hmm. So it's an expression of what she feels and what she hopes will continue to be, right?
Right.
There are other visuals that make similar gestures of belonging, which is how I characterize Walker's drawing. Notably, I'll just point out one, Gil Scott-Heron and Brian Jackson's album cover for their 1976 album From South Africa to South Carolina. And that has a gorilla figure holding one hand on the map of South Carolina's sort of quasi-triangular piece of a map, and in the other hand, also a somewhat triangular piece of a map of Southern Africa, and it's that power visual. It's a powerful kind of visual accompaniment to their famous song Johannesburg, mm-hmm. that helped really bring the anti-apartheid struggle to in the forefront of America's popular imagination. Mm-hmm. Now, those are visual texts, but I also mean to point to the ways in which that language, like a visual text, can help orient readers and act in map-like ways. So you get descriptions, right, or you get, as you say, reinterpretations of the physical scenery and of the social space that they, you know, that writers describe. Mm-hmm. And it's really powerful. So, you know, one example that I point to at the beginning of the book is the ways in which that, you know, the tensions really also emerge. This is not always a story of connection. It's also a story of disconnection. And, mm-hmm. and Lewis Nkosi in an essay describes his first visit to Harlem. Lewis Nkosi, a South African exile who ended up in the United States, and one of the first places he wanted to come to was Harlem because he had encountered that geography, that literary geography, in essays and in the novels of James Baldwin, and he had in his head imagined that Harlem very much resembled the townships of South Africa. And when he arrived in Harlem, he he found himself deeply disappointed because the literary map that he had read and placed on top of, or actually he had placed the South African townships onto the literary map of Baldwin's Harlem didn't actually meet his sense of expectation. He felt a deep sense of disconnection between those two spaces, and that encounter was important to register, not just because it's a point of disconnection, but because it shows again how powerful these maps are on the imagination, and the ways that it orients readers who encounter these imaginary maps.
Right. So Harlem, South Carolina, New York, Saroy, Joburg, Cape Town. I think you've given listeners a really great glimpse into just sort of the the expansive geography that you chart in the book. I'm really curious if you could talk a little bit about your experience conducting archival research for this book, given the expanse of this geography.
Yeah, no. So there were a number of archives that I found myself going to, and I'll I should just kind of list a few of them. I found a few archives in the United States. Okay. The Beinecke Library at Yale University was the first place that I went to, and it holds the papers of Hughes, some of Peter Abrahams and of Richard Wright. I also went to the Spelman College archives to do some work on Audre Lorde. Emory University's library, it's the Manuscripts Archives and Rare Books Library, holds the papers of Alice Walker.
Okay.
And then in South Africa, I went to the National English Literary Museum based in Grahamstown, South Africa. And that's where I found some work by and on Richard Reeve and Willie Kosetsile. And then finally, I went to Sarowe, Botswana, to the Kama III Memorial Museum. That houses all of Bessie Head's letters and her exchanges. Quite a rich, documentation, both of the letters that Head sent, but also the letters that she received. It's quite a collection. So each of these places really for me were filled with moments of revelation and surprise. And what they frequently did is, you know, as I encountered particular documents, as I encountered letters in particular, they made me rethink some of the assumptions that I was going into the archives with. They made me pause and make sure that I was not too simply characterizing a particular kind of relationship. It was sort of my encounter with the letters that made me reshape parts of my argument. For example, in the relationship between Wright and Peter Abrahams, I found moments of really sort of profound connection and elation, but also sort of moments of distancing. The letters would drop off. And I had to read what that dropping off meant, and then that allowed me to then go back to their autobiographical writings after the fact, where they would reference each other. So there was a kind of a piecing together of the again, the published work as well as the unpublished work, to think about how, we were talking about connections and tensions. Mm-hmm. How some of these connections were remarkable and profound and quite deep, both on a personal level as well as on a literary level. Mm-hmm. But they would sometimes be time bound. In other words, that they would last for a particular period, and then drift would happen, or distancing, separation, a difference of opinion would happen, mm-hmm. and then they would part company. Right. So it's in those kinds of sort of reading behind the published work that allowed me to see that.
Mm. So in this reading behind and this piecing together, just out of curiosity, which relationship or exchange between two writers did you find most interesting or surprising?
Yeah. I have to say that probably Bessie Head's exchanges were the most interesting and surprising. In similar ways, although sort of much more explicitly, Head really spent sort of poured herself out into her letters, and, mm-hmm. and she clearly understood that she was responding as a writer to a writer, mm-hmm. And was sort of extraordinarily impressive in what she had to say. These were not just quick notes like I suggested earlier. They really were sort of powerful interpretations and digests and really overviews of literature that Head herself was reading. But she was also incredibly effusive at the beginning of her exchanges with most of the African American women writers. The exception would be with Morrison, and she reached out to Morrison as an editor who was at the time still working at Random House. Mm. At the time, Morrison, I think, had published two novels, but she was still working as an editor. And so Head was reaching out to get her to see if she could get her work published in the United States, break into that market. But for the other three, these were moments of really rich, psychic and emotional connection, mm-hmm. that I think Head was seeking out and looking for. In two of those instances, the intensity of the ways in which the letters began, the exchanges began, were met with a kind of equally intense ending.
Wow.
Of the letters, right? And so that also led me to really dwell a bit on what we mean by transatlantic relation, and to what extent we want to what story we are trying to tell about transatlantic connections.
Right.
And what made it clear to me was what these letters made clear to me, along with their writing, was the ways in which that attempts at connection and moments of disconnection were equally a part of the narrative, mm-hmm. As are the moments of connection and full-on engagement, if you will.
Okay.
Those sort of either those missed opportunities or those breaks, I wouldn't call them moments of failure, but moments of parting ways is part of the story of Black transnationalism.
I see.
And that we have to account for that. The language that I use, because what was also striking in these letters is that they were most of these Bessie Head, Alice Walker, and Michelle Cliff were each talking about their gardens. In really, really striking ways in the letters themselves, but also in their published material, in their published text. Mm-hmm. And so the language I used was really had to do with cultivation. Mm-hmm. And I used that as the language to talk about, you know, the attempt to cultivate gardens, the attempt to cultivate community. And here we can refer back to that image, that really lovely image that Walker drew for Bessie Head. That attempt to cultivate a garden is filled with labor, and sometimes flowers spring up and sometimes they don't. Right. Mm. So that is part of the narrative as well.
That's really interesting. So I'm always interested in thinking about also the sort of contemporary echoes of these conversations today, right? And think about academic texts in general and how they help us to understand sort of events and conversations both within and beyond the academy. And so I want to ask you a little bit about the Roads Must Fall movement in the recent past, right, which ignited this public conversation, but also highlighted another transnational circulation of ideas, this time with echoes between South Africa and the United Kingdom. How do you think Grounds of Engagement gives us the tools to think through the ongoing circulation of ideas that contest histories of domination and tyranny?
Now, that's an important question. And of course, while my book ends with the end of apartheid, mm-hmm. these kinds of connections don't abide by neat historical periods.
Yes.
So you're right to point to the sort of contemporary echoes. You know, one of the aspects of that the Roads Must Fall movement has highlighted is the unfinished business of the post-colonial era, mm-hmm. and of the post-apartheid era. The fact that the university and South African society at large has not really fully decolonized. And so this is an attempt on the part of students to force that issue. So Roads Must Fall, just for anyone who's unfamiliar with the movement, really emerged out of an attempt to contest the placement, speaking of space, mm-hmm. How centrally placed Cecil Rhodes, the benefactor to the University of Cape Town, there was a statue in his honor placed centrally on the grounds, the upper campus of UCT, the University of Cape Town. And the need then that the students rallied around the attempt to remove this statue as a way of changing the setup, the messages, and even, of course, the curriculum of the South African University. This became a sort of a rallying point. And so the Rhodes statue eventually fell. And of course, as you point out, in the United Kingdom, there were attempts to contest Cecil Rhodes, both a British and a South African magnate, mm-hmm. Diamond magnate, who would be, you know, honored at, among other places, Oxford mm-hmm. University, and that students in the UK would then be contesting his stature and his sort of commemoration. There's also an echo here around that we might want to sort of draw with the attempt to remove Confederate statues in the American South, right?
Yes.
And not just the American South, but predominantly so. I'm also reminded in these sort of interconnecting struggles of the ways that Black Lives Matter, for example, in the United States, found mm-hmm. the strong base in universities. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you know, thinking about the question of geography at the heart of my book, It's also important to look at the scale and the site of the university. In South Africa, in the United States, in the UK, as well as other places around the globe, as a space where many transformative and radical movements have emerged. In other words, we can sort of look at spaces as universities in and of themselves, sort of situated in a particular country, in a particular region, mm-hmm. but also attempts to link up to other university spaces, right? Mm-hmm. That's not to say that universities haven't been the site of extraordinary conservatism. To be sure they have. But it remains a key site of contestation from which so many calls for social justice movements are issued. Mm-hmm. So the Rose Must Fall movement, also mobilized into a Fees Must Fall movement in South Africa, where students demanded that that parts of the social restructuring must involve changing who the universities as engines of social mobility should serve and how they should serve. Mm-hmm. Right? And this dovetails with questions of a neoliberal economy that reproduces so many of the racial inequalities of the past via economic channels. So students are, pushing back against a great deal of historically entrenched structural inequalities there. So it's interesting to think about these movements and frequently are very much sort of in conversation. That's not to say that there wouldn't be tensions between a Rhodes Must Fall movement in South Africa and a Rhodes Must Fall movement at Oxford University. Mm-hmm. That there are global inequalities to contend with as well, right? Right. And access to particular resources that differentiate the students, right? So there's solidarity, but there's also, again, the question of tension that can emerge. Yes. On this subject, or relatedly, a year or two ago, I remember students from South Africa involved in the Fees Must Fall movement. They were students from the University of the Free State who had been protesting, Skyped in with students at my university. And it was a fascinating discussion, both for the similarities and the racist experiences that they discussed, mm-hmm. but also for the gaps that they revealed. Mm. For one thing, at the time, tuition-free university education was really off the table in the United States. Right. And I think it'll remain that quite a challenge, precisely for how radically democratizing a free university education would be.
Yes.
Again, because it's a tool of social mobility. And so, how radically destabilizing a universal free education would be to the social hierarchies of race and class in the United States. Mm-hmm. I think students in South Africa and the United States share certain aspects in common, but they're also sort of facing different kinds of local settings as well.
I think your work makes such an important contribution to these ongoing conversations, right? By tracing some of the conversations, the echoes and tensions that have come before and that we're seeing playing out in spatial terms again, but also in different ways, in these different sites that you talk about. So kind of on this note of ongoing conversations, can you tell us just a little bit about what you're working on now?
Mm. Yeah, sure. I'm at work on another book project, and it revisits South Africa and the United States during the same period. I'm looking mm-hmm. at the apartheid era, but in a fairly different way. I'm really interested in exploring the ways that in an era of censorship under apartheid, books. And these are especially books written by African American writers that had become banned by the South African authorities, nevertheless entered into South Africa and sort of clandestinely circulated around the country to find an avid readership. So this is a project that keeps an eye on geography.
Okay.
You know, after all, I'm interested in points of entry. I'm interested in routes, channels, as well as points of dissemination. Again, this is my eye imagining moving dots along a map, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also keeping another eye on the role of formal institutions. So what particularly interests me is how institutions that operated legally, and here I'm looking at three different kinds, at least from the outset. I'm interested in libraries, I'm interested in bookstores, and in small presses.
Okay.
How these legally operating institutions operated at times behind closed doors to make bandwidths available. So this would involve keeping some books in the back room,
mm-hmm.
or literally under the counter, or hawking books sort of itinerantly on the streets. And all of this, of course, opens up questions of space and the interplay between visibility and invisibility. But it also involves a great deal of history, sort of fine-tuned individual institutional history, and interviews with the key individuals, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the bookstore owners, the librarians, people who worked in and for presses, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a plunge into literary history once more, but in a different vein. But I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I'm at the beginning, but I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
Oh wow, that sounds amazing. Well, I look forward to keeping up with this project as it unfolds.
Thank you.
On behalf of our listeners and myself, I want to thank you, Stefan, for joining us today to talk about the fascinating exchanges that you uncover in your book, Grounds of Engagement, Apartheid-Era African-American and South African Writing. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Annette. It was a great pleasure.